move swiftly on. Just a reminder of people in Guelph didn't see, and I hope they can see as well as here. There is an error in the assignment sheet, but it's a fairly minor error. There's a dx when it should be a dy. But if you actually look at how the integration is performed, that should have been fairly clear, just writing it. There is a replacement problem sheet on the website now. Also, I have to make a reminder that the problem sets are due in on January the 22nd. That is, I believe, next Tuesday. And the results are going to be posted on the web the day after that, at the latest. So if you don't get it on the 22nd, obviously you won't be able to get any marks. So I believe that the different areas of you already know the plan for how you have to hand in your assignment results.
Just,
yes?
You just handed in class a little bit?
Sorry, what was the question?
Do we just hand them in class?
Yes. Yes.
Right, so you're handing them in class. To the next, well, in this class it will be the next speaker. What do you mean?
I'm going to be here.
But I'm presumably also going well.
Yes. We will have somebody collectively there.
Okay. Today we're going to be talking about the issue of quantum non-locality, which is the second big topic after the quantum measurement problem that we all find ourselves talking about an awful lot in quantum foundations. And the basic structure that I'm going to go through is, I'm going to look at the EPR paper, and this is going to look at it very briefly. Now, this paper is quite a short paper, and one of the key ideas to it, which is what Einstein probably intended, is actually very, I think, very simple to get across. But for a variety of historical and somewhat possibly murky reasons about who actually wrote the paper and how it was interpreted, this actual idea has tended to be a bit lost, and a lot of other ideas have been discussed as well. Then I'm going to move on, and I'm going to talk about the sort of the meat of what I'm going to be talking about is something that's called the Bell inequalities. And this is the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument is going to present an idea that, in a sense, if one is to have understand the world in a sense that's local, that one actually has to have some kind of extra structure than just quantum mechanical wave functions. And this is a kind of maybe a hidden variable type theory. One of the extraordinary things about the Bell inequalities is a paper in 1964 in which it was actually shown that this wouldn't work, that the only for quantum theory, that the only way in which one could actually add hidden variables to actually reproduce the results of quantum theory would in itself be non-local. Now, there's been a lot of then further arguments about what this actually means. Now, one of the ideas of this course is to actually talk about up-to-date research. So the derivation I'm going to actually give of this isn't perhaps the derivation that's going to be most the one you're more likely to find in, say, appendices of quantum theory textbooks. It's going to be more general, and that's going to argue that there's actually weaker assumptions one can make than the ones that one is normally presented with. However, I'm then actually going to review what actually this means for arguments about locality and non-locality. And then we're going to talk at some of the loopholes in the arguments. And for a long time, there was a lot of arguments over this, and people got very fixated that there were no loopholes in the argument, except for the fact that then some people realized there were some loopholes in the argument. But the loopholes are a bit odd. So there's two kinds of loopholes, however. One of them is logical loopholes, and these are actually about the derivation of the theory themselves. And the other one might be called empirical loopholes. And these are actually criticisms of experiments that have been done to sort of test whether or not this Bell inequality is violated. Now, I should actually stress this logical empirical division is a division that I'm just actually giving for the point of this lecture. You probably won't find people actually categorizing this way. Most of the discussion on loopholes is largely in terms of empirical loopholes. So what's the EPR argument? Well, it's very simple. We have these kind of wave functions we've been looking at, where we have these entangled wave functions, where we've got two different objects, and one's got an x and y, and we have, and we can imagine this as being up, up, and down, down, like going through two slits. But we arrange it so object one with the x coordinate is heading off in this direction, and object two with the y coordinate is heading off to the right hand side. And we can think of this as being a wave packet up, and this as being wave packet down, and this being wave packet up, and this being wave packet down. And one of the things we notice about this is there's this correlation. When we actually make measurements about where these particles are, and where these particles are, we find, well, first of all, we only ever find one particle over here, up or down, and we only ever find one particle over here, up or down. But whenever I find a particle here, and for this wave function, then the other particle is found over here, also in the up. And if ever I find the particle here in the down channel, then the other particle is also found here in the down channel. And it's just actually, this happens and we observe it and we notice there's a correlation here. And what this, the very simple idea of the EPR paper, as opposed to some of the more complicated ideas that come in it, is just simply this. If I'm finding this particle here, and this is at some very remote distance location, so they've separated for a long time and they're very, very far away, and they're so far away that when I'm actually doing the measurement here, and doing the measurement, and someone else is doing a measurement over here, that the measurement takes place at some kind of space-like separation, so that there's not actually enough time, say, for a beam of light to get from this side of the experiment to that side of the experiment during the course of the measurement. Well, the question is, when I do the measurement here, and I find it in the up channel, I now know for certain that the measurement being performed over there is going to find it in the up channel. After I've done the measurement, I can state that there's a matter of fact about the world, that that other particle is going to be found in the up channel. And the question is, was there a matter of fact about that before the measurements performed over here? So I perform a measurement over here. I know there's a measurement going on over there. I perform a measurement over here. I see it up. I know that when the measurement's being performed over there, it's going to produce the result up. Was there a matter of fact about that before the measurement was being performed over here? Well, one option is it was already there. There was a matter of fact about it before the measurement was performed, that it's going to be found in the up channel. Well, there's only one other option, and that is wasn't a matter of fact about it. That I performed a measurement here, I see it enough, but there's still not a matter of fact in the world about whether it's going to be up or down here. But after I've performed the measurement, I know there's a matter of fact about the world. So my performing the measurement here seems to have actually made a matter of fact about the world at this remote location. It's made it determinate that the right-hand particle is to be found in the U channel. Now, this is a bit of a challenge, because influences, according to the theory of relativity, are not supposed to be able to travel that fast. I'm not supposed to be able to change what's the matter of fact about the world over here by doing something over here, when these are at space-like separation. So the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen argument more or less said that, well, that can't be allowed. So there must be a matter of fact over here about whether it's in the U or the D channel before the measurement is performed. And that's a fairly simple argument. There's a lot of subtleties to it, but it's a fairly simple argument. Now, I would like to emphasize, they never actually used the phrase locality or non-locality. They talked about separability. They don't even really make any reference to relativity theory, but given Einstein's name was on the paper, I think we can all assume that something like that was in the mind. That was a very straightforward, simple history. It came in the context of a whole bunch of arguments. Now, I just want to run through some of the history of the context of that, because there are some odd bits about this kind of history. Einstein first actually was working on quantum theory before anybody else, apart from Planck, and Planck had more or less given it up while Einstein continued working on it. And Einstein was working on the idea of photons. But he worried about the wave picture of the photon, about the fact that when you detected a photon, you detected it at a particular place. And we went through all these interference experiments, and we had this kind of idea of an incompatibility of a wave picture with the detection of a photon being at a particular place. And he thought the photon as a packet of energy meant that the energy had to all sort of localize instantaneously. And this wasn't actually very local. So he was worrying about locality in quantum theory long before quantum theory, even as we currently know it, existed. In 1927, there was a famous conference at Solvay. Now, along the way at that conference, and there's a book that's recently come out by Valentini and Bacigalupi that's on the course set of books. It's actually gone back and actually retranslated this into English and does a commentary, and it's fascinating reading. One of the interesting things is saying de Broglie actually presented a non-relativistic many-body hidden variable theory. For a long time, it wasn't thought that this was many-body, but if you actually go back and look at the proceedings, it turns out it was actually a many-body theory. And this was the precursor to the de Broglie-Bohm theory. Einstein repeated the 1909 arguments, but now in electrons, because now people were talking about electrons. In 1932, von Neumann came out with a book which included a proof that there were no hidden variables, which is kind of odd because de Broglie had actually shown that there was. This was very influential. And de Broglie essentially didn't push this hidden variable theory, and it sort of fell into abeyance for a long while. The Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper came out, and this was more or less, you can see it as in the context of arguing there must be extra structure than the wave function, there must be hidden variables. And this was argued against by the orthodoxy of the Copenhagen interpretation by Bohr and Heisenberg. And a long time goes along, and then a guy called David Bohm writes a textbook on quantum theory, which argues the orthodox Copenhagen point of view. And he produces a reformulation of the EPR argument that makes it particularly clear in terms of spin, but nevertheless says that this doesn't mean hidden variables exist. In fact, although he actually presents in this book a proof that you can't have hidden variables, which is very odd because a year later, he publishes a paper showing how you can have hidden variables. It's part of the history of this subject. Incidentally, also in 57, he, recognizing the fact that there's actually something very non-local, there's something very non-local about this particular hidden variable theory, he suggests possible modifications of this to try and make it relativistic, and that this would actually involve, you could actually have a test of these theories. And he suggested that the test for this would actually involve having to make changes on the different sides of the experiment at space-like separations, which is in advance of actually there being a really genuine empirical test that that actually would produce something. But they did actually make that suggestion long before it was suggested by Bell in probably one of the most important papers in the foundations of quantum theory. I would say certainly the most important paper since the Second World War, in which the Bell inequalities are first derived. And what it shows is outright is there is a problem between a non-locality that appears to be in hidden variable theories and quantum theory, that you can't remove that non-locality. And Bell also has a paper in which he shows why von Neumann's proof really doesn't apply to this kind of theory in general. Defends hidden variables. And often Bell's proof is actually argued as an argument against hidden variables. Bell himself actually was a defender of hidden variable theories, however. Also interesting is that although this paper in 66 was published second, it was actually written and submitted first. And it has it actually says that in this paper that he knows of no proof that you can't get rid of the non-locality. And then there's a footnote saying, oh, now I do. Because during the course of
this paper going through publication, he discovered the proof and wrote this paper, and it got published first. So what actually did he say in this paper? Well, I'm going to give a brief summary of the argument in this paper. And he starts with a similar kind of setup. I've switched it to UDDU. This doesn't really matter, it just means it's anti-correlated instead of correlated. So if we get up, then it must be down. If we get down, then it must be up. And the gist of Bell's paper is that if the theory reproduces those perfect anti-correlations, and it has these kind of locally predetermined outcomes, that is, if there's a matter of fact in advance, whether it's going to be up or down over here, regardless of what I do over here, well, that must satisfy an inequality. And he derives an inequality which has this form. Now here, what we've got is B, probability B and C, A and B, A and C. And A, B and C are the choice of choosing to measure something here or here. So this one is measuring B and C. Whereas this one is measuring A and B, and this one's measuring A and C. And by probability, we might say probability of getting up as opposed to down when we measure one of these things. And the details of this aren't particularly important, except for the fact that within appropriate choices, quantum theory can violate this. And Bell's conclusion, more or less, was that the EPR paper says that you either have locally predetermined outcomes or you have non-locality. And this argument says, if you have locally predetermined outcomes, you can't reproduce quantum theory. So quantum theory must be non-local. And that, I think it would be fair to say, is that was the way Bell saw it, and he certainly defended this point of view, I think. However, not everybody saw it the same way. The argument was also refined. The previous argument actually depended on the perfect anti-correlations of quantum mechanics. So it actually built something to do with quantum theory in it. In 69, there was a more general inequality derived. Now, this is actually often called the CHSH, as well as the CHHS. I've gone for the alphabetic ordering here, but I don't mean to actually imply anything on that. So the more general inequality, which we are going to derive, states something fairly similar. And this has been derived since 69 under a large number of different assumptions. So some of the assumptions that have been used are locality and completeness, local realism, local causality, we've got stochastic Einstein locality, there's been a thing called relativistic causality. Really to sort of get to the bottom of the argument, what is it that actually leads to this inequality? Because quantum theory violates this equality. So people are trying to explore what it is that actually is quantum theory is violating. What principles does quantum theory disobey? Now, Bell throughout used the term himself, local causality. And in particular, he did a derivation of this without any reference to quantum theory or hidden variables or any of that kind of thing at all. The actual thing is quantum mechanics is actually incompatible every single one of these, because every single one of these implies this inequality. So A implies B, not B implies not A. If C implies B implies not C. So if each and every one of those implies this, and quantum theory implies not this, then quantum theory implies not each and every one of these. But none of these is actually a straight thing called locality. They're all something a little more qualified. And that's caused a lot of debate. More importantly, though, is we've done an experiment. And we've done experiments, and the experiments have come out, and the experiments have violated this. Which means that whether or not quantum theory is true or not, as far as we can tell from our best experiments, and I will talk about how much we can trust that later, as far as we can tell from our best experiments, nature is also incompatible with each and every one of these assumptions. And that's going to be true even if quantum mechanics turns out to be wrong, if we have to replace quantum mechanics with another theory. And this is one of the reasons why this violation has been regarded as being described sometimes as empirical metaphysics. It's something very deep and goes beyond just talking about an existing theory. There's a sort of general class of principles that lead to this inequality. But this inequality seems to be empirically violated, so the general conclusion would be that any successor theory that is going to be compatible with our empirical observations is going to be incompatible with these assumptions. How secure is that knowledge? Well, as I said, there are some kind of loopholes, and I'm going to mention those towards the end, if we have time. So there's logical loopholes in which we can actually try and suggest mechanisms by which we avoid deriving this inequality, in which we say that, look, how do we actually understand how this could not be true? And then there's empirical loopholes, which are basically look at the actual experiment and criticize the experiment and say, well, actually, maybe this experiment doesn't tell us what we thought it told us. Maybe there's some hope that these things could be true after all. So we're now actually going to boldly go and derive the CHSH inequality. And first of all, I'm going to write a few things that are basic maths that we will need to refer to at some point, but I'm not going to put them on the blackboard because they are on the slides, because they are just basic mathematics. And they're about taking the magnitudes of numbers. So the first thing is the magnitude of A times B is equal to the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B. And the next thing is more or less a corollary of that, which is if you've got a number that's greater than zero, then the magnitude of lambda times A is equal to lambda times the magnitude of A. And the second thing is a well-known, hopefully, inequality, that the magnitude of A plus B is less than or equal to the magnitude of A plus the magnitude of B. And again, more or less, just a straightforward corollary of that is the magnitude of the sum of any set of numbers is less than or equal to the sum of the magnitude of numbers. Now, this is all should be pretty straightforward, because if you just think about it, if any one of these numbers is negative, this is going to be smaller than this. And if they're all positive, they're going to be equal. So it certainly can't be larger. And the third thing we need is, if we have a set of numbers which are between 0 and 1, so a set of probabilities, say, then we have another summation of the multiple of these numbers . So what we're doing is, if we've got a value here that's between 0 and 1, and we just multiply each of these figures by a number that's between 0 and 1, and we add them up, we're bound to have something less than if we'd have just added them up without multiplying them. Yes? These are scalars. These are all just real numbers.
This one here?
They're real numbers, they could be negative. So if A or B is negative, then it's going to be less.
So that shouldn't be too hard. We should be able to cope with that. So the next thing is, there's what I'm going to suggest as being, there's a root idea that lies behind a lot of the derivations of the inequality. And one of the ways of presenting this was put forward by a philosopher in a totally different context, as the principle of common cause. Now, he wasn't talking about quantum theory or Bell inequalities or any of that. He was actually talking about relativity theory, though.
And a very, very simplified version of this idea is that suppose we have two events. There's an A event that may or may not occur, there's B event that may or may not occur, and we've got the probability of A occurring and B occurring. And suppose there's a correlation between these events, and they don't just happen independently. For whatever reason, we notice that if A occurs, then the probability of B occurring is different to what it would be if A didn't occur. So they're not just statistically independent. Well, the simplified idea of this principle of common cause is a causal theory would require us to look for an explanation of that correlation. And this would be either the occurrence of the event A has had a causal influence upon whether or not B occurs, or the occurrence of the event B has had a causal influence upon the occurrence of event A, whether or not A occurs, or there was another event, a common cause, and the common cause C had a causal influence on whether or not A and B occurred. And the common cause is such that the existence of this correlation is explained by the occurrence or not of the common cause. And the idea of causality, this is one idea that put forward is what we mean by causality. Now, causality is a difficult word. There's a lot of different ideas of it. It's not just a correlation. So one of the examples people talk about when say it's not just a correlation is, suppose I had two torches, and I shone the torches at right angles to each other. And I held them so that the spotlight from one torch hit that wall, and the spotlight from the other torch hit the other wall. And then, at the point where they were actually intersecting, somebody stuck a pen in the middle of it and waggled the pen. Well, you would see waggles over one side and you'd see waggles over the other side, and they'd be very correlated. But you wouldn't say that the waggle on one side was causing the waggle on the other side. You would think that it was the pen in the middle that was a common cause of the waggles on both sides. And this is the kind of intuition that this idea is getting, is that whenever you see this kind of correlation, and you can't say that one thing is causing the other, then there must have been something else that was causing both. And then we take this idea. Oh, there's another thing about the theory being a causal theory, I should say. And that's, you can then take all the events in a theory . So we might have A, have B, so we had C. What I could do is I could say, well, point an arrow from C to A and C to B, and say that's representing C causing A and C causing B. And then, well, I could have other things. I could have Ds, Es, Fs. And then I can draw other arrows. Now, one of the things in a causal theory you want to avoid is ever getting a situation where you can follow these arrows and end up back where you started. Because if you do that, you have something that can be a cause on itself. You have what's called a causal loop. And the causal loops, rather famously, are supposed to involve things like grandfather paradoxes, where you go back and you shoot your grandfather when he was 10, and therefore you couldn't have been born and you couldn't have gone back to shoot your grandfather when he was 10. So the other thing we want is we want for this to have this kind of structure. Now, there's some technical names for this structure. You could call it, in the finite case, there's a directed acyclic graph. More generally, it's called a poset or a partially ordered set. Fortunately, the world seems to have given us a partially ordered set. It's called relativity theory. So the conjunction of that, the partially ordered set of relativity theory, which goes like this. If we have an event happening here, there's this future light cone structure to the event, and A can be a cause only of things that's in its future light cone. And there's a backward light cone of A, and A can be causally affected only by things in its backwards like cone. And you can have things that are elsewheres, and these may be, and this also has a backward like cone and a forward like cone, and you might find things that can be common causes of A and B, and they're in the overlap of the backward like cone, and you might find things that are common effects of A and B, and they're things in the overlap of the forward like cones. And this idea is called relativistic causality. These aren't the only definitions of causality. It's, as I say, it is a particularly complicated and sophisticated topic, just what we mean by something to be a cause. But this is a particular thing, and this is a particular phrase, and this is not a word I made up. You'll find this one in the literature. So suppose we have some region of space-time, and we're dealing with relativity theory here, and we have two types of events, big A and little a. And you're going to think of big little a as being some switch that we can switch to one of a number of values. So we can change it, and it points to 1 or 2 or 3 or 4. And we do that as part of our setting up of an experiment. And we can actually, it's some handle we have on an experiment that makes one experiment or another. Mainly, it's just a big switch that we can get hold of and change. And big A is like a measurement outcome. It's the kind of thing like rockets go off, balloons get released, the kind of things we were talking about. Or, yeah, the hockey stick pointing in one direction or pointing in the other direction. The kind of things we talked about as being measurement outcomes. It's going to be particularly easy, or particularly nice, because there's a nice set of papers that talk about it this way, to imagine it as just simply being our measurement apparatus has a box, and it's got a red light and a green light on it, and it's the red light flashing or the green light flashing. So it's something we can very see, this red or green light flashing. And over in some other region of space-time, we've got a big B and a little b. And these are exactly the same sorts of things. Little b is some big switch that somebody over here can flip to one different value or another. And big B is a green light or a red light flashing. And what's important for relativistic causality to be involved is we have the backward light cone, and we say, well, look, these are only the things, everything that can affect these has got to take place in the backward light cone. And everything that can affect B and B, everything that can have a causal influence, is in the backward light cone of big B and little b. So the only location one can find for any common cause is going to be in this red region, which we're going to call C. And then we apply the principle of common cause, and we say, well, look, any probability distribution we get involving the big A, the little a, the big B, the little b, given this, is going to have to factorize in this way. Because there can't be any correlation between these two that is not explained by the region of the common cause. Because these are space-like separated, and relativity says, or relativistic causality says, that what happens here can't have an influence on what happens here, or vice versa, except through this common cause that factorizes the probabilities this way. And the next thing we might want to understand is an idea of, I said A and B are free variables. They're big switch that the experimenter can change. So there's some experiment settings. And we have a choice to switch it to, we switch it to a number of different things, but we're only going to need to switch it to two. And we're going to label this as being over here, over on this side, one can flip the switch to A or A prime, and over on the right-hand side, with the Bs, we flip the switch to pointing to B or B prime. If the choice is free, well, what we're saying that the choice is free is that it's not fixed, it's not been set by this C, that we're actually, I can put it to whatever I like, I can make this probability distribution whatever I like. There's no way that C is actually forcing me to pick whether I pointed at A or A prime. And the same being true of all the other settings. And also, because A and B are of these different regions, then they also factorize. Well, we just said this is relativistic causality. We've made this assumption that they factorize, but we've just said they're free variables as well. So it's going to have that result. Now, if we take that and we just do a little bit of straightforward and manipulation, well, the probability of A and B occurring is this term. So we just sum over whatever possible thing C could be. I'm not going to specify it. Or we substitute this into here, and we find that these have no C in it, so they come out. And the sum over all the possible things C could be is always going to be 1. So we've just got the fact that these things are going to be statistically independent. Now, it seems a lot of hard work just to say the A and the B are statistically independent. But I'm going to do this the hard way, step by step, just to prove I haven't actually put anything in. And so you're going to have these slides, and you can go through step by step and make sure you know what assumptions were made. So when I'm using relativistic causality, I'm going to put that assumption up there in red. So now we get large amounts of lines of things. First up, I'm just going to set there's a general overall probability distribution on A, B, B, C. This is just a grand probability. I'm not going to say what it is, just suppose. This is uncontroversial, in a sense. This is just normal statistics assumptions. This, we're then going to take this, and we have the expression for this from relativistic causality, which factorizes it. Well, the next thing we're going to do is we're going to take this and we're going to conditionalize further. We're going to take this and we're going to conditionalize further. That's just straightforward statistics. But we also know that this term and this term are free variables. So they C disappears. The next stage is we're going to average it, we're going to sum over the possible C's or average over them. Again, this is straightforward statistics. But now we're just going to sum this, substitute this term into here. Finally, we're almost with the statistics part. We take our full expression here and we can conditionalize further on the probability of getting the outcomes given the experiment settings. But we knew from the free variables that that can factorize a little bit more into these being independent. I'm carefully saying what to do. And finally, that gets us to this result. Seems a large amount of effort. Just wanted to step through that. Now, there are assumptions that have been made there, and I am going to talk about those. But it does seem very, very straightforward. Most of this is just normal statistics, plus we've got free variables and we've got relativistic causality. Everything that follows is more or less maths. We count the red light flashing as being +1. We count the green light flashing as -1. So I write down in a book when I see a red light flashing +1, and I write down in a book when I see a green light flashing -1. And we all agree when a red light flashes and when a green light flashes. I'm going to define an expectation, a joint expectation. And this is going to compare results from both sides. And we're going to multiply the result in each individual run of the experiment, in the red and the green. So if they both flash red in one experiment, say +1. If they both flash green, it's -1, -1 gives +1. If they flash different, we get -1. It shouldn't be too complicated to figure out that that's what we get when we average that value. So this here is the probability of a red light flashing at A, red light flashing at B, given settings A and B, and so on for all the others. Well, we now substitute in the expressions we got from that on the previous slide. And this one factorizes. We look at that, it's got this nice symmetry, it factorizes into these two terms. One of which is just about red light flashing at A given AC, and green light flashing at A given AC, and the other term, red light flashing at B given BC, green light flashing at B given BC. And we're going to simplify that a little bit further by just writing these two separate terms as the expectation value at A given AC. And here we've got the minus for the green. We're going to assume that the red light flashes or the green light flashes and always one and only one flashes. That's going to turn out to be an interesting assumption. But as a result of that, we can easily see that this value has to lie between plus 1 and minus 1, and its magnitude has to lie between 0 and 1. And we're nearly there. Now we're going to make use of all this stuff over here on the blackboard. So, we're going to find this term here as just being the sum of these expectation values, but with a minus sign put in here. Why? Because we can. I'm not going to try and claim there's something special to this. I'm not going to claim there's something special to saying the plus one or the minus one, or to forming this. It turns out there is actually something special in the sense that it leads us to a certain conclusion. We could have put ones and twos and threes, we could have added up this different ways, but they wouldn't necessarily have led us to an interesting conclusion. Now, so there's no reason for doing a minus one here, other than it enables us to derive this particular inequality. It's a very useful thing. But it's not, unfortunately, any obviously physically significant thing. We now just substitute the values of this we've got. And we calculated each of these as just being these different terms. And again, we can factorize. We can take this term here and this term here and we can bring it out. And this term here and this term here and we bring it out and we get this minus sign appearing here. So we've got a difference in terms. And we take the magnitude and we have now to use one of our inequalities. We're using 2A inequality. So we've got an inequality here. We're also using, let's see, 1A inequality, because we've brought the probabilities out here. And these P's, these probabilities of C occurring, is always a greater than zero. Probabilities aren't negative. Well, the next thing is we're going to use 1 and 2 as our properties of magnitudes here, in which we're going to divide this magnitude here into separate ones. But fortunately, that's not going to change the way the inequality goes. So now we've got a magnitude of this plus term, plus a magnitude multiplying the magnitude of this minus term. Okay, the next step is we notice from 3, was there a question there? Next step we notice from 3 on the blackboard that these are between 0 and 1, and this is between 0 and 1, so we can drop those and still got the inequality working. And this gives us this expression here. And if we call that x and we call that y, and we call that x and we call that y because they're the same thing, because it is x and then y, that gives us an expression x plus y plus magnitude of x minus y. And that has the property of being between 0 and 2. Now, I don't know if that's immediately apparent to everyone. It was never very immediately apparent to me. However, if we consider very rapidly, we have the thing that each of these terms obviously goes between plus and minus 1. So x and y go between plus or minus 1. So we're in a box. If we have the x plus y, then So if we plot out the values of the magnitude of x plus y, we find we have a series of lines, minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2, 2, minus 2, no, that's wrong. Goes from 2, 1, 0, minus 1, minus 2. So if we take the magnitude of that, that becomes plus 1 and that becomes plus 2. In this region, we have x plus y, and in this region, we have minus x plus y. If we take the second term, we have a similar box, only now the lines go the opposite way. They go from 0 to minus 3, minus 1, 1, 2. X, minus y. And if we take the magnitude, this becomes 2 and 1. If we add these two together, what we find is we have a box in which in the different regions we have 2x, 2y, 2x, minus 2y, minus 2x. And it's a box of value 2, and then the squares are 1 and 0 in the centre. So it's between 0 and 2. Which means that this value is less than 2. If you average over a bunch of values that's always less between 0 and 2, well then, the result is going to be less than or equal to 2. So we've seen that the magnitude of this is less than or equal to 2, and that is our inequality. Now, my apologies for putting you through that very tedious sequence of calculations, which you could have all read in the book, but I want to go through it and show. All we needed was probability theory, some results about magnitudes, and these assumptions. The experiments have been done. Here's some schematics of genuine experiments. The first experiment that was done to really test this, there were a number of experiments in the 1970s, but they didn't actually change the settings between A and A prime while the actual experiment was in operation. And this is quite important, because if you don't change the experiment settings, well, maybe it's possible that when I flip it from A to A prime, some signal sets out at the speed of light and reaches the remote experiment setting. In the early 80s, there was an experiment done by Alan Aspect that actually switched the settings from A to A prime, from B to B prime, at a rate faster than a light photon could have got from one side of the experiment to another. And this was the first time this had been done. It's actually not been repeated very often. One of the principal repeats of it that's actually extended the range was an experiment led by a guy called Gregor Weiss, who is a professor at the University of Waterloo. Some of you may know. And he's probably, his experiment has been regarded as possibly now currently one of the state of the arts in terms of actually having done that. Well, one thing I haven't used or talked about, mentioned, is quantum theory. What has this got to do with quantum theory? Well, quite rapidly, we can actually do a calculation to show. We start off with one of our states, one of these nice entangled states that confuses us so much. And we're going to construct a red, a wave function that's going to correspond that when we measure that and get that result, it flashes red. And a wave function that corresponds to green. And similarly, for the other particle, y, we're going to find wave function red and green. But we've got this angle here, an alpha and a beta. Now, this can correspond to just some kind of setting that we're choosing. So this alpha or the beta is actually what we're choosing to change. Typically, it's like a phase shift or a beam slitter. beam splitter. It enables us to make a measurement of different things on different sides. Well, we can reverse these to get our up in terms of red and green, and our down in terms of red and green, and again on both sides. And you should be able to verify this quite easily by now. So we substitute these into this, and we end up with this horrendous big equation, which simplifies a little bit. But what's nice about it is it turns into being cosines and sine terms of alpha and beta, and alpha minus beta only. And what we're expressing here is, suppose I set alpha to be some value and my colleague on the other side of the experiment sets beta at some value, then what is the probability of us both getting a red flash? It's going to be a half cos squared alpha minus beta. And what's the possibility of me seeing a light flash red and my colleague see a light flash green? It's going to be one half of sine squared alpha minus beta. The minus sign disappears because we're squaring. Which means if I then count my reds as being pluses and my minus greens as being minus, and so does here, and we get together, then the expectation value we get is this long number, which actually turns out to simplify really quite neatly. After all that. So now we'll choose particular values of alpha and beta. As the difference is the difference, we're going to start, it doesn't really matter the overall value, so we'll start, we'll just pick a simple one. We don't do anything, is our A, and our my A prime setting is I have it moved by an angle theta, and my colleague's B prime setting is it's moved by an angle in the opposite direction, minus theta. And you plug those in, and we get out this. And what does this look like? And it looks like this. Does something funny here because we're taking the magnitude of it. Now, here's the interesting point. Here's the line of two. So this is the line that we're not supposed to be going above. Does anyone spot a problem?
We've gone above it. Oh dear.
And we go maximally above this at theta is equal to pi by 6. Where we get to 2.5. There are actually other experiments that can do even better than this, but in the particular case we've looked at, 2.5 is the maximum we're going to get. But 2.5 is definitely bigger than 2. And that's all we really need. Well, one might be worried about this, because what we said was we got this from the assumption that we have this idea of relativistic causality, that things are only going to be influencing things in their past and future light cone. And what this seems to be saying, is that if we assume things are only being influenced in the past, in their future light cones, we shouldn't be able to go above 2. We go above 2, so maybe we are able to influence things that are time-like separated. Well, if we could do that, can't we use this to signal faster than light? Can I actually use it by twiddling around with my, flipping my switches in such a way that my colleague on the distant side of the apparatus can actually see, figure out how I'm flipping my switches? Well, it turns out we can't. And a sort of very brief explanation of this is that I could choose two different things that I'm, my colleague can choose two different things that he's measuring. So he's going to flip his switch one of two different ways. And these are the different outcomes. Now again, what we want is the wave functions corresponding to the different outcomes to be orthonormal, and this gives us these conditions. Well, if we actually plug these into these and these into this, and we cross-check, this gets some conditions on the alpha. And these alphas are just actually a way of superposing one set of outcomes in terms of another. And this is just a property of quantum theory, of Hilbert spaces, in fact. So we have this relationship with these alphas. Now, over on my side of the experiment, I'm seeing, say, x as being something, given my colleague is measuring this thing. And if you plug through some of the examples on the assignment sheet, you will know that this is my probability distribution for X, given my colleague is measuring that. And if my colleague is measuring phi instead of chi, then here's my probability distribution for X. So the worry is there some way if my colleague can choose what to measure so that I can actually see a difference between these two? Some kind of, say, interference effect, some kind of point where we saw on the interference, where if I see an atom arrive at a particular place, I know something's been happening. Well, alas, if we take, I say alas, because it would be kind of fun if we could. I take this, and I substitute it into here, and find we get this, and when we subtract, we notice that we've got an alpha star, and we can take these out to here, but we then notice we have this, oh, and we can put that in there, we can make that a delta, lambda mu nu, when we sum over lambda, we find that we get the same probability distribution of X. And that's a simplified version of the no signaling theorem, but it's generally the case. What I see, the probability I see, isn't going to be affected by what my colleague has chosen to measure. But that's all. We were just saying there's this strange correlation that we're trying to understand. Well, we get the correlation, remember, when we looked at the red light flashing and my colleague's red or green light flashing. So once more, we see this situation is when we want to see the strange quantum interference effects, we have to bring together the results from both, from two different systems. It's only when we look at the correlation of the results together that we can see these strange quantum effects. One thing I haven't mentioned up until now is locality, which is odd because that's what this is all supposed to be about. I mean, this is what the lecture is entitled, Quantum Non-Locality. And that's because I actually started off by saying something relativistic causality. So the only notion of locality I was actually using is the idea of a relativistic space-time, and that the causality going on from that. And one of the reasons why is because this notion of locality is, well, what does it mean for a theory to be local or non-local? What does it mean for a theory to be local? What does it mean to be non-local? Well, obviously, it is not local. Okay, what does it mean for a theory to be local? Anyone?
Well, it turns out that
that is about the expected response you'll often get when you ask that question. People assume they know what it means for a theory to be local or to be non-local. But that's because what they have is particular examples of theories that they think are local or they think are non-local, and they point to the thing in that theory and go, that's non-locality. Okay, that's fine. Or they point to something in theory, that's locality. That's within a theory. What does it mean for a theory to be local or non-local in some theory-independent term? That's a more hard question to answer. So one idea is that, well, all the objects or the properties of the theory have well-defined locations. So we have this concept of space and time, and we talk about what is it within the theory that we actually want to attach reality to, what do we want to think has some kind of physical significance. And we say, do all those objects, do all the things that we want to believe, we believe in this way of viewing a theory, and then we commit to believing certain things are real, are all those things that we think are real, do they all have well-defined locations? And if they don't, then you're committing to believing in things that are real that doesn't have well-defined locations. It might be hard to say that that's a local theory. All of the objects can be affected only by other objects in the neighborhood. Well, that's another idea. First of all, once we've actually put the objects in particular locations, how well can they influence each other? This is kind of an interesting one, because is classical mechanics a local theory? Is Newtonian gravity a local theory? See, Newtonian gravity is an action at a distance theory. If I move, in principle, if Newtonian gravity was true, which it's not, but if it were, if I move this, I'm changing matter distribution. There's a gravitational effect on this hockey stick, even something like this hockey stick. The instant, according to the classical Newtonian gravity, there's an instantaneous effect across the rest of the universe, from the gravity stick being here or being here. So, there are classical action at a distance theories in which objects are placed in space-time, but they can influence other objects that are very far away. So one could argue that classical mechanics isn't a local theory. Well, classical mechanics in the 19th century was reformulated in the Hamilton-Lagrange formalism that people will probably be studying. And you could actually see in these Hamiltonian or Lagrangian formulations how that action at a distance works. And you can see, and you can construct theories that don't have that action at a distance. And there you have an idea of a local Hamiltonian. So there's an idea that then, okay, in classically you have objects having well-defined locality and the Hamiltonians only having local terms. And the local terms being that when you get an interaction between two objects, it only happens when they're in the same well-defined location. Another notion of locality, we can't use the theory. I mean, we can't use it to directly affect some other objects. In the gravity case, in principle, I could send my colleague away, and he's got an incredibly sensitive gravity detector, and I wave my stick around, and his incredibly sensitive gravitational detector can tell that I'm waving my stick around, and then I can signal to him. As we've seen, quantum mechanics, we can't signal. So this would be an example of an idea of locality that quantum mechanics, whatever all this argument about relativistic causality and so forth, doesn't allow us to direct us to actually use the objects of the theory, us to control things and send signals. So there's different notions of locality. There's different ideas that go into this. This is probably one of the reasons why there's a lot of argument over whether or not the Bell inequality means quantum mechanics is local or not. Now, I talked on that last slide about theory, a physical theory, whether a particular theory was local. What does it mean for the world to be local? I mean, there's a claim about doing the experimental tests on the Bell inequality that it's proved something about the world regardless of what our theory is. How do we actually understand that claim then? I mean, first of all then, does this mean the world is local? Well, what do you mean for the world to be local? In some way different from our theories to be local. We can ask the same kind of questions. So, looking at some of the ideas that were used that were to actually look at the derivation of the Bell inequality, one of the ones you'll find most often in textbooks nowadays is local realism. And this is an idea that says, locality is this properties cannot be affected by remote actions. Sounds like one of our assumptions of locality, one of our stronger assumptions. And saying realism, measurements have predetermined outcomes. Is that realism? Okay, who was here at the last lecture when I ranted on about what was realism or not? Was that realism, what I said realism was? No, it wasn't. This is certainly something that gets described as realism. It's a well-defined thing, measurements having predetermined outcomes. But realism is a wider term, so I'm going to stick that in quotes. Just a scare quotes, just to remind you. There's other concepts to realism than this. Determinism would be one way, but measurements having predetermined outcomes is the exact statement. I mean, you could talk about a theory being deterministic, but that means something more than perhaps measurements having predetermined outcomes. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it does, but here we have a worry about all these terms. Whenever you attach local realism, and then you say, what do you mean, locality realism? How much is this particular definition I'm giving for this term, dependent on the context? And people come up with these definitions, and then they show that it is or isn't violated in some circumstance. And the danger is to then claim that because it's violated in some circumstance, that it's just violated. And it could just be that you've defined something that makes sense in that circumstance, but that definition you used didn't make sense in another circumstance. And you've got to be very careful about locality and realism in that context. And there's a generally, this local realism is a classic case. There's a lot of people that think you can save locality by denying realism. Well, can you? Let's remember the EPR argument. EPR, and this is probably the source of this local realism term, is EPR gave us these two ideas. Properties cannot be affected by remote actions, and concluded that measurements must have predetermined outcomes. Now, the Bell argument can be reformulated, so you can derive this inequality by assuming measurements have predetermined outcomes and properties cannot be affected by remote actions. And then you can get to this inequality and the inequality is violated. Now, fine, you can conclude from the Bell point of view that one or the other must be false. But according to the EPR argument, you can't save this one by abandoning this one, because if you abandon this one, you lose this one anyway. Now maybe you don't buy the EPR argument we just provided at the beginning. Turns out, what's the assumptions that go into the EPR argument? Well, it's the idea that when you had a correlation on both sides, there had to be some explanation for that correlation. They didn't just occur. Well, that's kind of very close to the principle of common cause. One can argue that you can save locality by abandoning this and denying that you actually need to explain the existence of those correlations. Possibly. One of the ways to do this, one of the arguments was presented is the phrase locality and completeness. This has also been rephrased parameter and outcome independence. So the locality and completeness was presented in a way of, again, giving you an option between two things. Do you have local or do you have complete? You can save locality by abandoning complete. Of course, as soon as you do this again, well, that means you have to abandon local realism and you have to abandon locality and completeness, because both of them must be false. So if you want to save locality, you have to abandon realism and you have to abandon the explanation of the correlations and you have to abandon completeness. So you start to rack up a bit of a cost to save locality, it has to be said. What's the locality and completeness? Well, it's looking at this expression. This is a normal expression in probability theory. It's just a conditionalization. And what we do is we said, well, we go from our step from here to here that's required by our relativistic causality argument. And we do it by two processes. First we say, well, B, big B is outside the light cone, so that can't be dependent. We have this, then little b is outside the light cone, so that can't be dependent. And we say, well, there are two steps. Here's the outcome, whether it flashes red or green. And here's the parameter, the switch I set. Now, one of the things we knew from no signaling is that switching the parameter doesn't enable me to find anything out. So the argument is that maybe this is satisfied by quantum theory, but it's this step that isn't. So we abandon the need to actually explain the actual outcome, but at the same time we save the ability to move around parameters so we can't signal. Does this save locality? Well, in one sense, it certainly doesn't save relativistic causality, because you still have to drop the B, and that's just as much a violation of relativistic causality as parameter independence. But the argument would be that's just the occurrence of things. I don't have to look for a common cause. Even more complicated idea is local counterfactual definiteness. And this is more or less trailing on kind of ideas that you only will find is that unperformed measurements have no outcomes. Perhaps one could abandon local counterfactual definiteness. The idea that something happens over here, it can happen, like, say, randomly. If I change something differently, would it have happened different here? Well, if it was deterministic how it happened over here, then changing something remotely, if the world is local, shouldn't affect it. But if this is happening randomly, and I was to consider a counterfactual world in which things were different here, could I say it would be the same here? Well, no, because it's random. So Maybe it's just the fact that we're in a different world where something different happens here. I can't make assumptions about what would or wouldn't have been different about this fundamentally random thing here. And so when we're actually talking about combining these results of experiments, well, there's one experiment which I'm setting A, and my colleague is setting B. There's one experiment where I'm setting A, and my colleague is setting B prime. But those are two different cases. Well, how do I justify setting A and A prime and just adding up the results of the A and the B prime and the B? How do I justify that when there's a different experiment? I can't talk about what would have happened in the A prime, A B experiment if it had been an A B prime experiment, because it wasn't. It was an A B experiment, not an A B prime experiment. Well, of course, we haven't actually assumed local counterfactual definiteness in relativistic causality. It's not being assumed. All of these particular assumptions are all bound up in the idea of an idea that there is a determinate thing happening. It's all bound up in the idea that something definitely had happened in a sort of deterministic way. Generally, they're about looking at local hidden variable theories. One of the things about the relativistic causality argument is it's actually, all of these theories basically are arguments for abandoning relativistic causality. But they're all based upon denying predetermination of outcomes. And of course, relativistic causality doesn't assume that. So maybe the justification for these isn't actually so good when you actually formulate things in terms of relativistic causality. There are other loopholes. Logical loopholes. So it talks about classically action at a distance. So one idea is you just go, well, there you go. We looked at the correlations in the experiment, and we see that these correlations violate relativistic causality. So obviously, there just must be some way in which what's happening over on one side is having an influence on what's happening on the other side. The fact that it's happening faster than light, well, Newtonian gravity had action at a distance. It was good enough for Newton, it's good enough for me. And so the challenge is construct a theory that actually shows how the correlations take place. Well, we have actually a couple of theories that can do that. One is the de Broglie-Bohm hidden variable theory. Another is explicit wave function collapse models that can be argued to be a form of action at a distance. Another possible thing here is one has assumed that there was an independence between this C, this common cause, and what I was choosing to set over here. And we said that I was free to set whatever I liked as my experiment setting here, and I wasn't constrained at all. But there is another way in which a correlation could happen. And that's when I choose to set something like this, it goes back in time. And it affects something that happened in the past. And this is actually not so crazy as it sounds. One of the arguments is it could happen over the backward light curve. Now, there's actually been formulations of electromagnetism that use action happening over the backward and the forward light curves. So there are actual theories that have been developed to try and exploit this. It has certain advantages. It tries to make things reconciled with theory of relativity better. It has certain disadvantages in that as soon as you start sending things back in time, then we get back into this situation where we get causal loops. If I can send signals back in time, can I send a signal back in time to tell someone to shoot my grandfather? Which wouldn't be good. Why anyone wants to actually break themselves out of existence, I don't know, but anyway. It seems to be as soon as anyone gets a time machine, the first thing they want to do is go back in time and kill their grandfather. So retrocausality is one of the ways in which one can actually tackle this. There are people who try and build models of this. To date, I don't know of a single good model. That is a really one that actually works in all situations in a way that, say, the de Broglie-Bohm action at a distance or wave function collapse ones work. There are some toy models. Superdeterminism This is another way of denying that independence of the setting of the apparatus. And what this one says is, look, I'm not actually free to set the apparatus. I think I am. I keep setting switches, but actually, we're in a deterministic universe, maybe. I mean, if we were in a completely deterministic universe, I don't really have free will, I just think I have. I'm just doing things that were set up by the evolution of the universe from the initial conditions in the Big Bang. Maybe that correlation is, that initial condition was so cleverly correlated that every time I choose to measure A or A prime, actually this state, this common cause, was in a particular state or another state. And there was a correlation between this C common cause and my choice, because I didn't really get to choose. It didn't have free choice. Again, it's a logical position one can hold. I don't know of any well-developed theory that actually exploits it. The challenge on these kind of loopholes really is, don't say you've got a logical position. Show me a developed way of working out that position that explains the correlations we see. Exotic spacetimes, this is another one. This one actually is a rather interesting one, because this says, well, look, general relativity is a really funny case. How do we know that these opposite arms of the experiment are really far away from each other? Anyone ever heard of a wormhole? Come on. Who's heard of a wormhole? Thank you. You've all heard of wormholes. Maybe there's a wormhole connecting the two arms of the experiment, and if there's a wormhole connecting the two arms of the experiment, maybe when we get these entangled particles, they're really actually connected by a wormhole. And that means that you can actually send signals. So when I change the setting over here, it's not really space-like separated from the experiment over here, because there's a wormhole that connects the two, and the signal can get through really fast, faster than I thought it could. But it would be entirely consistent with general theory of relativity. Again, the challenge is, develop that theory, show how it is. And there have been people that have tried to work out like that through. So it's not completely crazy. Some people do try and flesh these things out. Splitting universes. There's a claim that the Everett interpretation is a local theory. This is really, in some senses, a challenge to the EPR argument, in that the EPR argument assumes one outcome or the other occurs. There's a determinate matter of fact on the remote setting that it's up or down. Well, Everett denies that. So Everett has a get-out clause straight away on the very beginning of it. The Hamiltonians used in quantum mechanics are completely local, in the sense we saw them as being local Hamiltonians in classical mechanics. So an advocate of many worlds would say, what's non-local in a many worlds thing? There's no action at a distance. There's no Hamiltonians. There's no instantaneous communication. And I can't signal. And of course, we could just reject the principle of common cause. We could say correlations occur. But so what? I mean, it's a fairly abstract principle. There's some philosopher in 1950s called Reichenbach said, we should believe that there's a common cause. Why? We're doing these experiments. We can't signal using these things. Maybe there's just actually that logic is faulty. What actually, how should we understand these loopholes? Well, there's a number of ways we could understand them. First of all, it's asked, what actually are they a loophole to? And one thing is certainly every one of them is a way of actually blocking this derivation of the inequality. It's a way of saying that the logic we used to derive this inequality was faulty. It looked simple, but, well, debatable. Did it look simple? It is simple. All you need to do is probability theory and magnitudes. But, nevertheless, we made assumptions. These are the kind of assumptions we made. I didn't highlight them, but they were there. Are they a loophole to locality, then? To the non-locality? I mean, some might argue that the action at a distance and the retrocausality, or even the exotic spacetimes, these aren't a loophole to locality. These are just a mechanism by which the non-locality takes place. One could argue that rejecting the principle of common cause is just simply abandoning the idea that the world is governed by local causes. in which case you can't say you've saved the locality by abandoning the idea that the world is governed by local causes. As in much, the argument is dominated by people who take particular positions and want to justify their position is the right one. And they do this by looking at all the other positions and say, well, all the other positions are unreasonable, so I must be right. Unfortunately, as one person said, every position is unreasonable in this particular argument. I mean, there's just... What about the experiments? I mentioned there were other loopholes. Well, said it earlier, one of the things you have to do is this switch between A and A prime, between B and B prime, it's got to happen fast. It's got to happen fast because if I set it up at A, and there's time for a signal to get across the experiment and tells the other side that I've actually switched to A, then maybe it knows enough to actually be able to make sure the correlations come about. Again, there's not really a theory, well, some early attempts to develop local hidden variable theories would have actually been revealed by this. As I say, most of the local hidden variable theories that people actually work on are non-local anyway, so. This is also being called the locality loophole in the literature, which is a bit of an odd name, I find, because the whole point is testing locality, you can't say there's a loophole because your experiments are in the same location. It's just not a test of locality. But sometimes you will refer to this as referred to the locality loophole. There is, in fact, an experiment that allegedly has closed all the experimental loopholes, except this one. I guess this is the principal thing that the experiment's supposed to be testing. It's arguable. There's a loophole called memory. A lot of the experiments, the settings take time to respond. If they go click or flash red, it can't just immediately flash red or green again. It takes a bit of time to respond. And there's a question, well, maybe actually it has some memory of what the last thing it does, and the question of what actually happens is actually conditionalized on what happened in the previous one, two, three experiments. It turns out if you can actually, you can get a local hidden variable theory that would be very, very contrived, in which the experiment, each side, remembers what happens and then just actually what turns out that you can actually get it to appear to violate the Bell inequality. Why does it only appear to violate the Bell inequality? Because what it has to do is it has to not record certain things. It has to not flash red. If it gets a result that goes, I can't answer all these ones. If I flash red or green in every single experiment, it's going to violate the Bell inequality. Or, if I flash red or green in every experiment, and it's a local thing, it is not going to violate the Bell inequality. Quantum theory wants it to violate the Bell inequality. So you can have these conspiratorial theories that try and simulate quantum theory while being local. How do they do that? Well, what they do is that assumption that the probability of red plus the probability of green is equal to one is not true. It's never true in an experiment when we actually go out and do it, that every time it flashes red or green. Sometimes it doesn't flash on one side and it does flash on the other. Sometimes they both flash at once. This is just true in experiments. It's called noise. It's called detector efficiency. It's called things that go wrong. And normally we control for these things. And we actually put error bars on it. Well, it turns out that you can exploit this noise and you can question whether or not a really contrived local theory can actually simulate breaking the Bell inequalities by having certain settings and saying, if I'm getting measured at this particular angle, alpha, I'm just going to choose not to flash at all. So it depends on the detector efficiency not being 100%. It depends on the not being noise that causes things to flash when they shouldn't do. It depends on you not being quite sure whether or not the flash red, then red here, is associated with the green or the red here. Which one was happening when? And it's also associated with something called fair sampling. Fair sampling is a particularly difficult one. Fair sampling is saying, well, just supposing when I got this probability of C, I'm just unlucky, maybe. maybe these particular experiments just haven't been representative. When I choose a particular detector setting, well, it wasn't actually representative of what the hidden variable state was or the common cause state was. All of these can actually be controlled for. All of these are things that experimenters, good experimenters, know about and take into account. There's been some fuss about these for a while. There was a lot of argument to try and actually establish these. People who really did believe in local hidden variable theories spent a lot of time and invested actually looking into these experiments and pointing out this. And eventually the message got through, and the experimenters went back and actually did much better experiments as a result. But to date, there hasn't been a single example of a loophole-free experiment. Now, it has to be said, there also isn't a single example of a local hidden variable theory that shows how it can exploit all these in all the kind of cases that we know of. So we're in a little bit of an unsatisfactory situation. Oh, I should say, what actually changes when you introduce these noise components is we actually get this term. It's slightly different. So when we actually combine the results of actual experiments, we find that with the extra noise, this is the efficiency of the detector. Now, it's the generalized efficiency taking into account a large number of other things, but what we actually need is for this to get higher than we actually detect. We can get as high as actually 2 root 2. I said 2.5 wasn't the best we could get. We could actually get 2 root 2, which is slightly higher than 2.5. But to get that good, the detector efficiency has to be less than 0.82. Roughly, if that was the only loophole, this would mean that the detector efficiency has to be right, has to pick up 82% of photons. So if you could pick up 83% of photons and you still got a value of 2 root 2, then that would be a loophole closing experiment. But as I say, to date, we haven't got that good yet. But it's possible to be done, and we can keep pushing it. So there's experimental work that can be done. I don't have the best up-to-date things. The problem is there isn't actually a single experiment. What there is a large number of different experiments that do better at different things. So there's one experiment that does actually get to this to 100%, but it's the one that actually unfortunately fails the locality loophole. There are other experiments that close the locality loophole but fail on the detector efficiency loophole. There are some people that claim that if you close that those two experiments between them individually close the loopholes, therefore the loopholes are closed. This isn't the case. It is in principle possible to have something that would exploit both loopholes, that would fail each individually ones, but still roughly go over there. Roughly, as far as a plot is concerned, there is a diagram one can draw in which one has detector efficiency on one side and noise on another, and one can factor other things into it. Broadly, if you have this as being our 0.82, what we have is, for a loophole-free experiment, we would have to be in this region. Broadly, most of the experiments are in this region, and there is one that's supposed to be out here. As you can see, we haven't got any that are in there. Now, it's not impossible. There's no reason to suppose we can't do it, and it's just a matter of experiment. We keep building up, we improve the sensitivity, and eventually we either find it breaks down or we end up in this zone. Empirical loopholes in principle can be closed. And when they do, we'll all just be left to arguing about the logical loopholes again. Okay, I think that's it for today. Yeah.
one, each one of those directions, x and y. So we see